Hi there. This is Gwenda Bond from the Office of Communications, and we'll get started in just a couple minutes. We're going to just wait just a few more minutes to see if other people log on, and then we will get started. Hi there. Thanks for joining us. This is Gwenda Bond again, and I'm going to turn things over to Commissioner William Hacker, and he's going to give some opening remarks. And then Dr. Craig Humbaugh, our state epidemiologist, will talk a bit more. Your lines will be on mute only for the beginning of the call, and you can email in questions if you want to me at gwenda.bond@ky.gov. That's gwenda.bond@ky.gov. Or we'll open up your lines after the presentation, and you can ask questions then. So with that, I will turn things over to Dr. William Hacker, our Commissioner of Public Health.
And good morning, all. This is Bill Hacker. Just to give you an idea of the background that I have, I began my medical career as a private practicing pediatrician in Corbin, Kentucky from 1975 to 1993. And so I do have experience being on the front lines taking care of patients. Dr. Craig Humbaugh, the state epidemiologist, also began his medical career as a private practicing pediatrician in the Nashville, Tennessee area. In addition, in our department, we have Dr. Rob Brawley, who is a pediatric infectious disease trained specialist, as well as Dr. Emily Ludlow, an infectious disease specialist assigned to us from the CDC. The point I'm trying to make is that we actually have several physicians in our department who have experience with infectious diseases and also have been on the front lines, similar to where you are today. This has been a complicated situation since it first began appearing in the world in March with H1N1, the novel virus. This morning's call is a new one for us, and it's part of our ongoing efforts to try to outreach to the clinical community to address questions, provide information, answer questions, and do the best we can to provide the support you need to take care of patients. The biggest challenge for all of us is that as this is a new viral infection, information has been evolving and changing, and as it evolves, we sometimes have to modify our guidance, both at the national level, the federal, as well as the World Health Organization level. That sometimes is obviously frustrating for clinicians who receive guidance, implement their clinical protocols, and then a new guidance comes out. It's not that we've been wrong in our guidance, it's that the information changes as we get more information and experience with this outbreak. We have a lot of information we want to cover this morning. We'd like to have feedback at the end in any manner or mode that you want to communicate with us, either phone calls or emails or letters, to give us feedback about the effectiveness of this phone call this morning, as well as the previous efforts on our part to get information out to you through clinical guidance, posting on our website, posting on KMA's website, American Academy of Pediatrics websites for the Kentucky chapters, and all the other modes of information sharing through the local health departments, Kentucky Hospital Association, and others. So with that, I'm going to introduce Dr. Craig Humbaugh and let Craig walk through some of the information we would like to share with you this morning. Craig?
It's good to talk to you this morning. Thanks, Dr. Hacker. First of all, let me start out by saying there's a couple of places that you can access all the information that I'm going to speak about this morning, and that is primarily, number one, at our website, which is healthalerts.ky.gov. That's healthalerts with an S, all one word, .ky.gov. So that information, if you'll click on that website and then click on at the top, it says Health Professionals, and then that'll give you several options, including a clinician toolkit that we're going to talk about a little bit more, and most current guidance from CDC and from Kentucky Department for Public Health. I'll start out with that, making sure you know that. In addition, you can send us questions after this program. If you have specific questions, you can send it to our Department Operations Center, and our email there is CHFSDPHDOC. That stands for Cabinet for Health and Family Services, Department for Public Health, Department Operations Center, so that's CHFSDPHDOC. @ky.gov. So let's start out talking a little bit about the pandemics and the current situation here in Kentucky. So we have been reporting, as many of you know who are out in the field, we've been seeing widespread flu activity here in Kentucky for over a month now, and this is very unusual for us to see this in September and October. We had a low level of H1N1 activity all throughout the summer, again, which was an exceptional for us. We have had over 99% of the specimens that have tested positive for flu at our department, our Division of Laboratory Services, have tested positive for the H1N1 strain. So almost all flu that we're seeing circulating now as part of this outbreak is the new H1N1 strain. So that's important to know. In addition, we're going to talk about this a little later. We're going to talk more about vaccines, but we've been allocated now a total of over 175,000 vaccines, and over 100,000 of those have been shipped already to Kentucky, and many of you have enrolled as providers to give that vaccine. We're going to talk more about that later. So first, let me talk about specifically mechanism of transmission and then symptoms of disease, assessment, diagnosis, treatment, and reporting. I think most of you know that the H1N1 novel strain is transmitted in much the same way that seasonal influenza is transmitted, and that is the droplet transmission. And that becomes important when we want to think about how we prevent this transmission of H1N1. Symptoms are also similar to seasonal flu, and that's fever, headache, body aches, cough, and sore throat. And those are very similar to seasonal flu. What we're also seeing with H1N1 are more gastrointestinal symptoms. So we're seeing also more vomiting and diarrhea than we would normally expect in the regular strain of seasonal flu. As far as diagnosis, most folks will not need to necessarily be treated or tested. And the reason for that is we know that all the flu that's going around right now in Kentucky essentially is the H1N1 novel strain. And so if people have signs and symptoms of flu, we can assume that they have the H1N1 strain in most cases. There are a few exceptions of things that of patients that we'd like you to specifically test, do a definitive PCR test for H1N1 for, and you can send those samples to our Division of Laboratory Services. And those are samples from patients who are, one, pregnant, two, have a clinical condition that has required hospitalization, or three, are living in an institutional setting where previous cases have not been identified. And that includes institutions such as boarding schools or nursing homes or mental health facilities, all those types of institutions. And we have more guidance on how you can send specimens to us. Now, if patients do not meet those three criteria, then obviously you can send, and you still feel that they need definitive testing, then you can send the specimens to your regular reference labs that you normally use, such as Quest or LabCorp. I should mention, too, that rapid sensitivity of the rapid flu tests range anywhere from 10% to 70%. They're fairly operator-dependent and sometimes dependent on the brand that you are using in your office. Therefore, a negative test will not necessarily rule out influenza. I think if you get a positive test, then that's more of an indication that your patient does, in fact, have influenza A, but a negative test may not necessarily rule out influenza. So that's a little bit about the testing and diagnosis. Let's talk just a bit about reporting. Influenza by itself and clinically diagnosed is not reportable here in Kentucky. However, there are some influenzas that we do want you to report. We want you to report any laboratory-confirmed influenza cases, and that's part of our regulation by Kentucky law, any laboratory-confirmed cases. And then, and those should be reported the regular way that you normally report to us, which is an EPI 200 form, or calling us at 888-4. There are a couple of other specific types of patients that we'd like reported with influenza, and that is all hospitalized pregnant women with influenza-like illness or confirmed influenza A infection, and then all pediatric seasonal and H1 influenza-associated deaths. And I think those are the two that we're really concerned about having reported to us. So, again, patients who are pregnant, who have influenza-like illness or confirmed influenza A, we'd like you to report those to us at 888-9-REPORT, and then pediatric influenza-associated deaths. Again, 888-9-REPORT. The other laboratory-confirmed cases, you can just generally send us or fax us an EPI 200. So thanks for your help with that. A couple of new things that we've had come out from CDC specifically about treatment, and we're going to talk more about treatment in a few actually, let me just go ahead and talk about antiviral treatment.
Before you do that, let's get the email address again.
Okay. Let me send you the email address. So there's two addresses that you can send your questions to. One is gwenda.bond, gwenda.bond@ky.gov, and the other is barbara.j.fox@ky.gov.
They're with us here.
And they're with us here in the room, and we'll be happy. At the end of this session, we're going to take some questions. Hopefully, we'll have 15 or 20 minutes to do that. So let me move on to antiviral treatment, and CDC has just issued some new guidance on October 16, 2009. You can find this on our website or on the CDC's website at cdc.gov. And specifically, are recommending that certain groups of folks receive early empiric treatment with oseltamivir or zanamivir, the two antivirals that are recommended for folks with H1N1. And the virus does seem to be very susceptible at this point to the use of those antivirals. But we need to use them judiciously, for fear that the virus will become resistant at some point if we do not. But these are the folks in that that are recommended currently to receive early antiviral treatment, and that within 48 hours of the beginning of illness. And those are children younger than 2 years of age, persons 65 years of age or older, pregnant women and women up to 2 weeks postpartum. And that includes women who are following pregnancy loss, and then persons of any age with certain chronic medical conditions or who are immunosuppressed, and then persons younger than 19 years of age who are receiving long-term aspirin therapy. And the reason for that is that these folks are more likely to have severe illness with the novel H1N1 virus if they do get sick. Now, we're going to, I think most of you know that this illness has primarily affected young children and teenagers and young adults. So those over 65 seem to have had some immunity from a strain that was circulating during their lifetimes. However, the reason for them to receive antivirals early is if they do get sick, and they are more unlikely to get sick, but if they do get sick, then they're more likely to be hospitalized. So therefore, they are in the category that should receive early antivirals. So what can be confusing about this is because they are less likely to get the illness in the first place is that they are not on the high priority list for H1N1 vaccine, and we'll talk about that a little later, but it's important to make that distinction. You can find antiviral guidance about how much, what the dosage should be and the length of dosages for your patients. Again, that's on CDC website and our website. So I'm not going to go over that, but I would encourage you to go there. Let me point out one other thing about antiviral treatment, and that is that we have been experiencing a shortage of the pediatric oseltamivir. That's the pediatric Tamiflu suspension. It's only that formulation that is experiencing a shortage. And we do have some guidance for you about that. The good news is that even though that's in short supply, the commercial supply of antiviral capsules for adults is in plentiful supply right now, or is certainly adequate across the state and across the nation. So what can occur is that pharmacists across the state can make up non-sterile suspensions from those adult capsules, and that can be given to children. So we have some guidance for you on that. We'd like you to prescribe the medication in milligrams rather than milliliters, because the pharmacist will make up the suspension at his or her pharmacy. It's not a sterile suspension, so therefore any pharmacist can make it. It doesn't have to be compounded at a specific type of compounding pharmacy. And we're told by the Kentucky Pharmacists Association that most any pharmacist can do that. Let me talk briefly while we're speaking about antivirals about what happens to patients who cannot afford antivirals, or if at some point in the future the commercial supply becomes unavailable. We have developed an antiviral distribution plan for the state and federal stockpiles of antiviral medicines that we hold here at the state level. And we have worked with the Kentucky Pharmacists Association on this plan, which has been in effect now for a week or two. Hasn't been widely publicized because of our fear that, let me just put it this way. We want to make sure that the antivirals get used appropriately and get to the folks who need them most. But there is a plan in place now throughout the state to provide antivirals for uninsured or underinsured patients who are no longer able to pay. At this point, the insured should be able to get their medicines that you prescribe through the antivirals you prescribe through the regular commercial pharmacy system. But those who are uninsured or underinsured can now, if you will write on their prescription KPHARX at the bottom of their prescription, if you know that when you see them they are unable to pay, then you can direct them to one of the participating pharmacies in the state that are participating in this program. The KPHA, the Kentucky Pharmacists Association, has signed up over 100 pharmacies throughout the state, and they continue to enroll more into this program. I would encourage you to call your local health department if you're unsure where the participating pharmacies are in your area. Again, we haven't widely publicized which pharmacies those are because we didn't want them to be overwhelmed with people asking for this type of medication that hadn't had prescriptions. But we do want you to be aware of where those are in the state. All right, let me move on to talk about some types of prevention strategies and then also some recommended exclusion periods. So I think most of you know that one of the cheapest and most effective ways to prevent the spread of influenza, whether it's seasonal influenza or H1N1, is certainly hand washing. So we do encourage you to make sure that your patients understand how to wash their hands well with regular soap and water for 20 seconds. and to do frequent hand washing. And if hand washing facilities are not available as an alternative, to use alcohol-based hand gels. The hand gels are very effective except when the hands are actually visibly soiled. And so our primary, we primarily recommend hand washing, but as an alternative, alcohol-based hand gels. Another important strategy that the individual patient can take to prevent illness is coughing into the elbow, to the bend of the elbow. And this allows the actual droplets that contain the virus to end up on the person's sleeve, and they're very sensitive in general to light and to drying out, and so therefore they don't get transmitted then from person to person as they would if the person is coughing into his or her hands. Let me say a few words about personal protective equipment for both healthcare workers and non-healthcare workers. This has been a subject of some controversy throughout the United States. Kentucky Department for Public Health, our guidance has been posted on, again, the Health Alerts website, healthalerts.ky.gov. And this guidance is somewhat at variance with CDC's guidance and with OSHA's guidance. And the reason for that is there's kind of a, a lack of definitive information, and even the experts disagree about what guidance should be used. Our guidance follows that of the World Health Organization and that of the Society for Healthcare Epidemiologists in America, which is SHEA. And we are recommending that healthcare workers use surgical masks rather than N95s for their daily, day-to-day, face-to-face interactions with patients who are confirmed or suspected to have influenza. And the reason for that is we feel it's a droplet transmission disease, and surgical masks should be effective in preventing disease. A recent article in JAMA from October 1 of this year, if you'd like to look at that, although it has low numbers, it came to the conclusion that surgical masks were just as effective as N95s, or you could look at it from the other. The N95s were no more effective than surgical mask use in healthcare workers. So I would urge you to look at that article if you have specific questions. And I'm hoping that more science will come out in the future as this situation evolves.
Use N95s for high risk.
Yes. And then we do recommend, however, in our guidance that N95 respirators or higher should be used by healthcare workers that are performing high-risk activities such as bronchoscopies or nasal pharyngeal swabs or other activities where the virus might be aerosolized. So those are the exceptions. We'd like to reserve the limited supplies of N95s that we have throughout the state and throughout the nation for those high-risk activities that might aerosolize the virus. So please take a look at that guidance if you have any questions. And again, it's on our website and it's dated September 21st, 2009, and it's called Modifications of Existing CDC Recommendations about Infection Control Precautions for Healthcare Personnel. Just a word or two about whether the average person should be wearing masks or N95s, and our guidance has been similar to CDC in that regard in that we do not recommend that in general. Now, the exception would be someone who's sick who may want to him or herself wear a mask if to protect his or her caretakers at home, for instance. So that would be an exception. But in general, in public, for most people, it's not necessary for them to wear either a surgical mask or N95. But we do actually encourage them, as we said before, to wash their hands, cough into their elbows, and, of course, stay home from school or work when they're sick. So speaking of staying home from school or work, the recommended exclusion period for now for both people in the general population, school kids, and for healthcare workers is 24 hours fever-free off antipyretics. So that's for everybody. They make a return to their regular work activities or school activities after they are 24 hours fever-free off antipyretics.
I might, this is Bill Hacker, I might interrupt there just one second. There was a story this morning on NPR about from the United States Air Force Academy where they were pointing out that people do shed virus even longer than 24 hours. And the CDC's response was, yes, that's true, but we have to have some practical guidelines. We can't ask people to stay home until they're no longer shedding virus because of that can be variable. It can be up to days. And the peak period of shedding and the most highly contagious period is just prior to onset of symptoms to the time of 24 hours after asymptomatic or after afebrile. So while they may still continue to shed, they're much less contagious, and to continue to isolate people just is too disruptive to society. So that's the CDC's response back. Okay.
Great. Thank you. For your patients who have questions that may be general questions and they are not specific to their health, for those that are specific to their health, we ask that they call you as their usual health care provider. But for those who are just in general want more information about H1N1 or seasonal flu, we've set up a hotline for the general public. It's been well received. We've had about 200 calls per day since this was set up about 2.5 weeks ago. The hotline is done in conjunction with the folks at Poison Control at Norton Healthcare, and the number for the hotline for the general public is 877-843-7727. Again, this isn't a number for providers. It's a number for the general public to call with questions that they may have. 877-843-7727. It's staffed by trained nurses, and the nurses will refer patients with specific health care issues back to their providers for more detailed information or for recommendations from you all. Lastly, let me talk about vaccine for H1N1 vaccine amounts, formulations, target groups, and distribution and safety of the vaccine. And this is, of course, a hot issue right now. So I'll start out with talking about the fact that, again, we've received, as far as the H1N1 vaccine, we've received some vaccine from the federal government, but not a lot. What happens is, the federal government gives us a new allocation of vaccine from which to draw on each week. That's Kentucky's portion of the federal stockpile. And that vaccine is coming rather slowly, and the reason for that is that each lot of vaccine has to be approved from a safety standpoint before it can be released by the federal government and placed into the federal stockpile so that states can draw on it. Once that happens and we receive an allocation for that week, then we have sub-allocated that vaccine to the different 56 local health departments that we have across the state, and we do that generally per capita. So we then divide that up, and they have an allocation from which they can order. Then if you are a provider and you can become a provider by calling your local health department, and the forms are available at healthalerts.ky.gov if you're interested in becoming enrolling as a provider, then you can receive vaccine through your local health department. So they tell us each week, well, we want this vaccine sent to our hospital or our providers, or we want vaccine sent to us at the local health department. And they know the area better than we do here at the state health department, so we're relying on them. But it's a challenge for them, especially when they have very little vaccine. So we only have enough vaccine to vaccinate right now about 4% of the population, so we still have very little in terms of overall coverage. But the good news is we expect more, especially in November and in December, and we'll continue to get weekly shipments, we hope, of at least around 50,000 doses a week. There are two types of or two main formulations of vaccine, and these are similar to the same as for seasonal flu vaccine, and that's the injectable H1N1 vaccine, and that's the shot. And then, of course, the nasal vaccine, which is a live vaccine. So those are the two main kinds of H1N1 vaccine. At this point, since we don't have a lot of vaccine available in the state or in the nation, we recommend that those who are enrolled to provide the vaccine, that they give the vaccine to those who are in target groups. And the target groups for H1N1 vaccine are pregnant women, household contacts, and caregivers of children less than 6 months of age, healthcare workers, persons 6 months to 24 years of age, and persons 25 to 64 years of age who have a chronic medical condition. Now, we're often asked, again, why aren't seniors a target group? And the reason for that is they appear to be at less risk for getting H1N1. There seems to be at least some partial immunity in this group to the disease, perhaps from a virus that was circulating during their lifetimes. Therefore, we're asking, as Dr. Hacker always puts it, grandparents to go to the back of the line and let grandchildren go to the front of the line for the H1N1 vaccine. For the seasonal flu, we want both flu vaccine. We want both children and grandparents to go to the front of the line. So that's the difference there. Again, you can sign up to be a provider by calling your local health department and signing a specific provider enrollment agreement with them. And then if you do that, you will receive a clinician's toolkit. The toolkit is also online at our Health Alerts website. It has 10 different sections, a lot of what we're talking about today, including the different formulations of the H1N1 vaccine, who it should be given to. It has also sections about reporting of adverse events from the vaccine, how to do mass vaccination clinics, and also prevention activities for your practice for H1N1. It's important for me to emphasize that if you sign up as a provider, that does not mean you necessarily are saying that you will give vaccine to folks who are not in your practice. But it does say that you're willing to give vaccine to your healthcare workers in your practice and also other people in your practice as the vaccine becomes available. About 50% of the vaccine we've gotten so far is the nasal vaccine, and about 50% has been the injectable kind. As you know, the live nasal vaccine can only be given to healthy people ages 2 through 49 years of age, just like the seasonal flu vaccine. So it's important to remember that certain target groups, such as pregnant women, for instance, cannot receive the nasal vaccine. There's some, I think, misunderstanding about whether the live nasal vaccine can be used for healthcare workers. And in general, the recommendation is that it can be used for most healthy healthcare workers up to age 49. The only exception would be those who work with severely immunosuppressed patients that actually require a protective environment for their well-being. So that would be like a cancer ward or another area that bone marrow transplant unit, those kinds of things. But for most people, we know that from day to day they may see immunocompromised patients, but they can still receive the live vaccine. ACIP says that live vaccine transmission from a recently vaccinated person causing clinically important illness in an immunocompromised contact has not been reported. Therefore, this rationale of using it or avoiding the use of it in these severely immunocompromised or healthcare workers that will be working with severely immunocompromised patients is simply a theoretical risk at this point. But because it is a theoretical risk, we do recommend injectable vaccine for those who work in those specialized kinds of units. But for most healthcare workers, they are able to take the live vaccine if they're healthy and they're age 49 years and under. And they may return to work on that same day. All right. Well, I think that that's most of what I wanted to talk about, and I think Dr. Hacker has a few additional comments.
And I won't be nearly as long, Craig, but more on a global thing, just to give you some background. There's disputes with, I run into people all the time who say this is being overblown. The fact is that we are seeing a lot of flu in September and October in Kentucky. We have had 8 deaths so far that we've reported, and out of those 8, 3 had no chronic medical problems at all. One was 39 years of age, one was 28 years of age, and one was 13 years of age. And this is similar to the patterns we're seeing across the United States. Most people by far get this flu, fight it off by themselves, don't need to be on antivirals, and handle it just fine. But there's certainly categories of people who are greater at risk, and that are those folks who have chronic illnesses, kids especially between under 2, and then that group between 2 and 18 seem to be at also higher risk. Nationally, we see between 50 and 80 pediatric deaths per year from flu. We've already had in the United States, I think, 76 deaths since May 1, and of that, 43 deaths have occurred since September 1, and half those were between the ages of 12 and 17. So that there are a group of folks out there who do get this virus and then develop either adult respiratory distress syndrome or secondary bacterial pneumonia. But we are encouraging from our public relations and public information to the public is that if you're mild, stay home. But if you're not sure or if you have chronic or risk factors, be sure and check with your health care provider. And if you have really difficulty breathing or very sick, certainly be seen. Or if you start recovering and then have a rapid deterioration, don't wait around because it can move very quickly. The CDC has a hotline for people who want to talk to an obstetrician gynecologist about women who are pregnant. Let me give you that number. It's just recently posted, I believe, as of yesterday. 404-368-2133. 404-368-2133. That will be answered by a certified OBGYN physician at the CDC, and you can have direct consultation regarding women who are pregnant and the flu itself. Last Tuesday night, a couple of days ago, I led a panel discussion on Kentucky Educational Television at 9 p.m. with a statewide broadcast, and we had 12 people answering the phone in the phone bank, and numerous calls came in. Actually, several hundred phone calls came in, more than I was expecting. And the phone calls were really very reasonable. A lot of questions about clinically specific issues, but it really demonstrated the fact that the public still has a lot of interest in this and a lot of questions, and I'm sure you're dealing with this on a daily basis. So refer the general people that public to general information to the hotline that Dr. Humbaugh mentioned earlier, but if you have specific things that we can help you with, let us know, and if you see ways that we can do a better job of communicating with you or the public, we're always open to your suggestions. With that, I think we're ready to see if we can get some.
I think we have one.
I have one more thing, Dr. Hacker. That I forgot to mention, well, actually a couple of things. Children that are under 10 years of age should receive 2 H1N1 vaccinations to be fully protected, and they should be a month apart. The H1N1 vaccine and the seasonal flu vaccine cannot be given, the live formulations of those cannot be given at the same time. They need to be given 1 month apart. But any other combination can be given on the same day or no waiting period between them. In other words, if you're giving injectable and live, you can do that on the same day, or you can give 2 injectables with no waiting period. And that's important. And then finally, didn't emphasize the risk of bacterial infections as a complication of influenza. I think you all know that that is an important complication of seasonal flu, and we're seeing that as well as a complication of H1N1 and 2009 novel flu. Specifically, there was an article in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report from October 2nd of this year that talked, there was a study that CDC did on folks throughout the country that had died of novel H1N1. And what they found was about a third of those patients had severe bacterial complications, and the most common of those was pneumococcal disease. And so we do have a vaccine for pneumococcal disease and Pneumovax, and we do recommend that that be given. So we would like to encourage you to encourage your patients. In general, we have relatively low uptake for Pneumovax here in Kentucky, and we encourage it not just for those who are over 65, but those who have chronic illness who are indicated for the vaccination as a way of, again, trying to decrease the number of deaths that we're we could potentially see from H1N1. So I think we'll let Gwenda.
Okay. I don't have any questions via email, so I believe we've opened up the line. So if someone has a question, feel free to jump in.
I have a question.
Could you identify yourself, please?
Yes. My name is Dr. Divya Cantor. I'm in private practice in OBGYN in Louisville, Kentucky. And we're going to receive our first H1N1 vaccine shipment today, this afternoon. But my question is more of an ethical dilemma that I have. I'd like to be able to vaccinate my staff and my patients, but I don't know how many vaccine doses I'm going to get today. But I question myself on who should I actually give those first doses to.
Yeah, this is an important question. So I'm not sure everybody could hear you, Doctor, so I'm going to repeat the question because it was difficult for us to hear. But the scenario here is that she's getting a few doses of her first few doses of H1N1 vaccine, and the dilemma is, should she vaccinate the staff or should she start vaccinating high-risk people, or how should she most effectively use those? And I think it's a tough question. But in general, I think that you shouldn't feel guilty, for instance, about vaccinating your healthcare workers and your staff first or very early on, because we need healthy healthcare workers to take care of people with H1N1. And certainly we don't want healthcare workers spreading the virus. And so I think that you can be assured that we would support you on the decision to vaccinate your staff in the first group of folks that you use this vaccine for. But we would also encourage you to use this vaccine for those who are young children, especially those children at high risk, and for pregnant women, all those folks who are in the target groups. And hopefully you'll receive more vaccine in the weeks to come. Does that help to answer your question?
Yes, that does. Can I ask another question?
Yes, go ahead, please. And if you could, can you speak a little louder or closer to the microphone?
Yes, let me try that. Again, most of our patients are pregnant, and ACOG did discuss the preservative in the vaccine, and I was wondering if you could make a point or two to the audience about that, that it's safe to.
I'm sorry. Say that question one more time.
Can you address the preservative that's in the vaccine to be given to pregnant women?
Right. And I think CDC says that at this point that pregnant women can receive the preservative-containing vaccine. But for those of you who you are a bit shy of that, or your patients are a bit shy of receiving that vaccine, the injectable vaccine that contains the preservative, there is also a small amount of preservative-free vaccine that is available as well, and more will be becoming available. But a small amount of that has come into Kentucky. We've tried to distribute it to almost every region, and we hope that the local health departments that will specifically target their obstetricians practices for that vaccine. But vaccine that's injectable with that does contain preservative can be given to pregnant women as well.
Thank you.
Remember, that's true with seasonal flu vaccine too, so I ought I know some folks have questions about safety of the vaccine, and I didn't talk too much about that. But I will emphasize that the vaccine is made, the H1N1 vaccine is made with the same processes as the seasonal flu vaccine. And the reason we have two different vaccines this year is that most of the seasonal flu vaccine was already manufactured in April by the time that the H1N1, the new strain, emerged. So therefore, they've manufactured a different vaccine, but it's very similar to the seasonal flu. It's just targeted against the new H1N1 virus. Great questions. Do we have other questions from the line? All right. Well, thank you very much, and we hope this has been helpful. And please let us know or provide us with some feedback, as Dr. Hacker said at the beginning of the call, about whether this was helpful for you or whether you would like to see future calls. I do urge you to go to the website that I talked about and Dr. Hacker talked about, healthalerts.ky.gov, for additional information. Because I know this is a lot to digest. We know that you all are very busy clinicians, and we really appreciate you taking the time out today to participate in this call.
And just one note, we will post a recording of this call. We'll put it in the health professionals area on the Health Alert site, and I don't know if some of the associations may make it available too. So if you want to recommend any of your colleagues check this out, or if you want to go back and refer to it at any point, it will be there on the website later this morning.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.